chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass makes heaven the middle of it. Grass makes heaven the middle. We are grass makes heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. We're going to be covering some very, very interesting clips today and news items. And first, we're going to start off with Robert Barnes. He's a host of American Countdown, and that's run on the InfoWars Network, I believe. But Robert Barnes has put out some very, very amazing reports over the years, over the last few months. I don't think his program has been running now just for a few months, and I'm not sure if it's still out there. But he's done some amazing interviews and reports. And this is about a report involving not only a couple of court decisions, but also involving some very, very interesting characters that were released. Susan Rosenberg is who he speaks about, who was released by Bill Clinton on his last day. He commuted her sentence. And I know all of this controversy now about Roger Stone. Let's go back and see what Bill Clinton did. He released a convicted terrorist, Susan Rosenberg, and Robert Barnes does a fine report on it. So here we go with Robert Barnes, American Countdown.
Welcome to another edition of American Countdown. What if I told you about a story that involved one of America's most notorious communist terrorists? A convicted one. One that was intended to serve almost 60 years in federal prison. One that was part of a special project to create a form of a brain or a mind or social control by the prison that she was originally located at. What if I told you that that story of a violent communist intersects with billionaire donors from the Buffett family, from the Soros family, from prominent San Francisco big tech millionaires and billionaires and lefty donors? What if I told you that, in fact, this individual was one of the controlling individuals for directing funds and for the creation and instigation of Black Lives Matter? This is the story of the unusual tale of how a notorious, violent communist terrorist, by her own self-description, led to today having a major influential and institutional role in the direction of charitable dollars to Black Lives Matter in its creation, organization, instigation, and operation. But before we get to that story, let's talk about some of the other extraordinary events occurring today and yesterday around the world. We can start with the extraordinary case of the Supreme Court issuing two decisions this week. And the first also involves Mr. Soros. The case decision issued by the United States Supreme Court on June 29th, published to the world, is titled Agency for International Development, popularly known as AID, versus the Alliance for Open Society International Incorporated. Now, who might that be? Well, the Alliance for Open Society International Incorporated is heavily funded by the George Soros Open Society Foundation. Well, what were they doing up at the U.S. Supreme Court? Well, they were receiving substantial funds from the government. So this was another case of George Soros getting money from the government to undermine the government that he has promised to undermine publicly in a wide range of contexts. So you have that peculiarity. But what else were they doing in front of the U.S. Supreme Court? Well, it's because George Soros organizations refuse to say that they oppose sex trafficking. That's right. All that was required was Congress passed a law in 2003 saying that you will not receive monies from the United States unless, for various charitable activities, unless, or public policy activities, unless you agree that to a policy explicitly opposing sex trafficking. Well, George Soros' organization refused to do so, and initially the U.S. Supreme Court said that the U.S. version of open society could, in fact, refuse to oppose sex trafficking and yet still get government dollars. The question was, would the same apply to the international version of the Open Society Foundation and its Alliance for an Open Society International? Well, of course, this also relates to issues relating to immigration and relating to the travel ban. As the Supreme Court made clear, foreign citizens outside U.S. territories do not possess rights under the U.S. Constitution. The U.S. Constitution restrains what the United States government can do within its own borders and protects United States citizens wherever they may be. But what it does not do is protect citizens of every other country and every other nation, no matter where they are located, particularly when they are located outside of the continental or territorial United States. So that was the core legal ruling, and it said that Congress could therefore require George Soros' Open Society International divisions to comply with a policy that requires they at least explicitly denounce sex trafficking if they're going to continue to receive government money. Imagine, for years now, George Soros' organizations, a man that's a very wealthy man, billionaire, very politically active, has been getting money from the taxpayers to influence public policy around the world while refusing to denounce sex trafficking. That is the extraordinary position he was in. But after the Supreme Court decision this week, no more tax money for George Soros' international organizations, Alliance for Open Society International, unless he finally and his organization finally denounces sex trafficking, one of the world's worst worldwide whores. That wasn't the only big Supreme Court decision this week. The other was Espinoza versus the Montana Department of Revenue. And the significant part of this decision, issued June 30th, 2020, is finally it's a breakthrough to allow parents to pick the schools they want, even if those schools happen to be religiously oriented. For a long time, there's been a misapplication and misappropriation of the First Amendment doctrine that converted religious expression, the right to religious expression, because that's what the First Amendment protects, into a prohibition of religious expression if there is any tie in any way, shape, or form to the state. Indeed, this idea that the First Amendment is freedom from religion is not in the First Amendment. It is a freedom of religion. Now, it's a freedom of religious expression that precludes a state church from favoring and from the state favoring one religion over another, but it was never intended to be a provision to discriminate against religion. I had this exact argument with William Kunstler, a lawyer who I otherwise have respect for, when I was a young student at Yale University more than a quarter century ago. And what I argued with Mr. Kunstler then was that his position on the First Amendment prohibited and punished religious expression, that it targeted, that it basically treated people differently solely because of their religious affiliation or association, and that the point and purpose of the First Amendment was meant to be a protection of religious expression in all of its forms. It was not meant to be a means by which the state could institutionally oppress religion or discriminate against religion. Well, finally, the U.S. Supreme Court has come around to that exact same position that I argued for back when I was just a kid student at Yale against William Kunstler. In Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue, the Montana government had basically made it impossible for you to use provide private scholarships for private school tuition and receive tax credits for that if what you were doing, if that money was going to a religious institution. Suit was brought saying that this no aid to religious schools provision discriminated against religious schools, as it clearly did. The Montana Supreme Court said that it was okay to discriminate against the religious schools because that's how it misinterpreted the First Amendment, the same way William Kunstler did with me 25 years ago. The Supreme Court made clear what the law has always held and what the First Amendment should always provide for, which is that there is no basis to discriminate against a religious school, quote, simply because that is what it is. What you can prohibit is the government giving money for the purpose of establishing a church, for the purpose of doing religious training of a particular religion, of favoring one religion over another. But what you cannot do is discriminate against someone simply because of their religious affiliation or association, and that is what these laws did. That's what many of these laws do, right at the heart, right at the center of schooling and education in America, which has been revealed as being as important and significant as at any time when we look at how people currently have a certain kind of indoctrination that reflects a limited perspective of the world based on an ideological orientation of the secular left. Of those people who are mostly anti-religious, anti-church, anti-institution, anti-spiritual, and in many cases flat out just anti-American. People who have bought into those who condemn and criticize America. Do you ever wonder why it is and how it is that the radical left is so at ease with radical Islamic fundamentalism? Because what they share in common is denunciation of evangelical Christianity. What they share in common is denunciation of Judaism. What they share in common is denunciation in particular of America. That they're more driven by their venomous hatred for America than they are their own ideas and ideals of tolerance, openness, freedom of thought, freedom of ideas, freedom of expression, freedom of speech, or even in their particular case in parts of the left, their opposition to religion magically vanishes when the religion is radical Islam, even though it is likely the most dangerous ideological application of religion in the state atmosphere in the modern world. So this decision was a critical decision because it reopens the state coffers and reopens the tax benefits and tax credits to anyone, regardless of the fact that they may want to go to a religious school and get tax benefits in that way. Ultimately, this has implications for vouchers. It has implications for private scholarships and tax-funded scholarships in a wide range of contexts. It means religious schools are back in a meaningful way. This decision probably is far more impactful than the decision that people have been critical of, either in the abortion context or employment discrimination context, because this goes to the core of the ability to educate our own kids the way we choose and to incorporate a religious component of that and not be discriminated against solely because of our religious association or affiliation. This decision has far broader and wider reaching effects than many of the decisions that got the higher and broader attention. So those two decisions the Supreme Court issued are those that were issued because of the appointees of President Trump. So it is another effect to prevail in that context. But now let's go to our bigger story tonight, and this is an extraordinary case involving, and it starts with a young woman, no longer that young, but was at one time, Susan Lisa Rosenberg. Now, she started out as a young middle-class family in Manhattan, went to an elite left-leaning private schools, the Walden School and then Barnard College, went on to become a drug counselor at Lincoln Hospital in the Bronx, someone became involved in the practice of Chinese medicine, and from there, she became even was an anti-drug counselor and acupuncturist and at health centers in Harlem. But somewhere along that way, she ended up going down a radical left-wing path. Indeed, by her own self-description in her book about entitled American Radical, she became a far-left revolutionary terrorist. So this isn't, you know, the Marxist, communist, far-left, terrorist. These labels are not labels others have imposed upon her. These are labels that often she herself has publicly embraced, or the organizations that she was a part of publicly embraced. Her key organization was the May 19th Communist Organization, formed in the 1970s. That was active throughout the late 1960s, the 70s, and then the early 80s. They were co-complicit with the Black Liberation Army, which was itself a spinoff of the Black Panther Party, and was also itself connected to the Algerian and Vietnamese communist movements, openly and overtly. In fact, the Vietnamese embassy in Algeria was given to Eldridge Cleaver, who was the co-founder of the Black Liberation Army. But that isn't, and then they took their violent action to a whole new level. So whereas other people have, you look at, say, something like Weather Underground or the Students for Democratic Society, some of those were not nearly as violent as the May 19th Communist Organization. Several of those were not as overtly communist as the May 19th Communist Organization. What she did throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s became very active in all the far left causes, including feminism, including the Puerto Rican quote-unquote independence movement, which was often also violent and terroristic during that time period, was connected, of course, to the Weather Underground and other revolutionary organizations. But she was one of the most successful Marxist terrorists in history. And to give you an idea, she was involved in the bombing of the United States Capitol, the bombing of the United States Naval War College, the bombing of the New York Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, and most notoriously was connected to the famous robbery, the Brinks robbery that led to the death of multiple police officers, was connected to breaking out people from jails and prisons on a routine basis, including those who are currently today still on the lam, is associated and affiliated with some of the most wanted people in the world and on the most wanted list of the FBI. She was a fugitive through most of the 70s and early 80s because she had already been identified as one of the top criminal terrorists in the history of the United States. The only reason she wasn't more well known is a lot of her efforts didn't lead to many deaths. That's it. That because their bombs had limited effect and impact by coincidence often and by timing, she's not more famous and infamous and didn't go end up with a death penalty. She was a fugitive for many years and was arrested only in 1984 with an accomplice when she was unloading 740 pounds of dynamite and weapons from a car into a storage locker in New Jersey. Convicted of the explosive possession and given the recognition of her long-standing criminally violent multi-decade history of extraordinary levels of violence, she received a 58-year federal prison sentence. Now, why is she still not there today, given that happened way back in the mid-80s? In the mid-80s, she still would be serving time under that prison sentence. Two reasons. First, she was one of the first two inmates of the high-security unit, a high-security isolation unit in the basement of the Federal Correctional Institution, they call it FCI, at Lexington, Kentucky. There was a wide-ranging allegations about what that high-security unit was all about. It led to multiple lawsuits involving the ACLU and Amnesty International. A court would later call it a living tomb, a deliberately and gratuitously oppressive location and place. It was ordered closed. It was so bad, it was ordered closed by a federal judge. And why was all that? Well, there have long been allegations that this was, in fact, an experimental underground prison practicing mind control techniques on high-profile political targets, not just isolation or sensory deprivation, but 24-hour surveillance, strip searches, all the kinds of control over visitor access, control over exercise, many of the things we've heard about from MKUltra, they were trying on these targeted political prisoners to see how successful certain forms of mental and psychological torture, certain forms of mind control could effectively change behavior. And so that led to a more sympathetic perception of Rosenberg in certain parts of the legal world. Rosenberg would serve time all across the country. She would develop a master's degree in Antioch from Antioch University. She would become a writer, and she would become very active in activism concerning AIDS. So how is she out on the streets? Well, in 2001, 17 years or so into her prison term, President Bill Clinton, on his very last day in office, there were two very controversial moves he made. One was he pardoned, famously, Mark Rich, who had given a very large donation to make sure that happened through various family members and friends. And his other one was he commuted the sentence of Rosenberg so that she would be immediately released. New York officials were outraged. Police officials were outraged. FBI officials were outraged. They pointed out her long history in some of the most violent criminality in history, of the United States, in the modern history of the United States. That she was, to the left, what some of the worst Klansmen were to the 1960s civil rights movement of the South. And to a certain degree, had been more successful for a longer period of time in terroristic violence than even the Klan had managed to be in the 1960s in the South. So she was someone who they did not even pursue a bunch of charges that they believed they could prosecute her for because they thought she was already going to serve 58 years anyway. Instead, however, to the shock of some of her, of those who knew her, she gets released by President Bill Clinton on his very last day in office. She would then become an activist, and quickly the foundation world, the money that creates the funds for many of these activists to politically agitate, quickly came to the rescue of Rosenberg. She taught criminal justice and literature at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City. She was an adjunct professor. She would be offered a teaching position at Hamilton College. And ultimately, she would find herself right at the center of the foundation world at an organization called Thousand Currents, an organization that itself had actually been named something else for 30 years prior, but for political convenience purposes, changed its name in 2015. So that gives you some idea of who Rosenberg is, what her background is, the scope and scale of her activities. You can go to Influence Watch and learn more about her. It talks about how she's a convicted domestic terrorist, radical left-wing activist, youth spent protesting war and racism in America, a member of Weather Underground, a member of other radical organizations which use violence as its tool for political change, was involved in all kinds of explosives and weapons and bombings and various forms of assaults. She was may have been the likely getaway driver in the infamous Brinks armored car robbery that left one guard and two officers dead, connected to the escape of a wide range of prisoners and criminals, many of whom would ultimately escape any justice at all. And this included the various people involved with and connected to the Brinks robbery. So, for example, she was part of the organization that did the Brinks robbery in 1981, the May 19th communist organization. It included members of the Black Liberation Army. It also included this criminal coalition known as the Family, was organized in part by Tupac Shakur's stepfather. So imagine that. Tupac is connected to all of this. That is how you get Tupac's stepdad was part of the organizations and associations pushing this. They were pushing a, quote, new Africa movement to create their own state. Where have we heard that recently? To create your own state, a racialized justice movement, a movement about defunding police, a movement about reconstructing society, a movement justifying violent change and violent resistance. She would then go on to all her wide range of criminality and other allegations of violent course of conduct before getting caught, and then getting the extraordinary commutation and the ability to be outside of the political process in a meaningful manner, to be outside of facing criminal prosecution and criminal punishment for what she had done and did. Now, her involvement in the Thousand Currents organization goes to the fact that Thousand Currents was originally known as the International Development Exchange, IDEX. It is a long-standing left-leaning organization from the mid-1980s, and its organization was the principal one that sponsored from the get-go the Black Lives Matter movement. Shows that millions of dollars earmarked just for the Black Lives Matter movement. It was the principal and primary organization helping to do so. One of the primary organizations using the George Floyd death to instigate riots around the world. That gives you an idea for what that background is.
That was a very, very good report from Robert Barnes. And what we have in this country is we're in a hell of a predicament We've had the socialism, Marxist communism, and all that that has been taught in our colleges and universities. And now we have a large population out there that believes in socialism, that is against private property, and is just in revolt and rebellion right now. And one of these groups that Millie Weaver recently is showcasing on her site, Millennial Millie, and we'll put up, we'll embed her full report, but we're just going to be playing a small part of it. But it has to do with Sunrise Movement, and what's happening is that these revolutionaries are seizing upon ecological, environmental issues and mobilizing a lot of young people together and directing them against these targets and to create chaos and to reinforce this rebelliousness that is going on now. So here we go with Millie Weaver and her report, special report, with undercover, you could say, agents that have been reporting for and studying this system for 2 years. Here we go with Millie Weaver.
Our undercover source spent 2 years infiltrating extremist organizations, including the Sunrise Movement.
Sunrise Movement.
Green Revolution that's taking place.
We are building an army of young people to stop climate change.
A far-left organization radicalizing high school and middle school-aged children for high-risk political action. The idea is to make it look like it's an organic grassroots movement of youth.
So we were able to, like, accomplish it.
Yeah, definitely.
When in reality, there are adults behind it facilitating and creating it.
Some of the team that's working to help put this thing on in the higher levels of support, including trainings, partnerships, communications, logistics, and above all else, recruitment.
Right now, you guys are all taking the crash course, Green New Deal and the coronavirus, but these are all the other courses that we offer. We encourage you guys to sign up for it.
My involvement with the Sunrise Movement, going through the recruitment several times as different people, to go through their training for middle school and high school as a different person, and to come through as a different person at a very mid-level range, to where to them I'm many different people. They are connected with other activism groups through something called the Action Network. The Action Network is an organizing tool that allows them to do data mining and to have a mass data analysis of how to organize their movement.
They use Hollywood connections, DC insiders, celebrity status, and a media spotlight to attract young people to their organization.
Abby just graduated from high school. This summer, she is taking a gap year and working as a fellow for the Sunrise Movement.
Go.
We are a youth-led movement fighting to stop climate change and create millions of good jobs in the process.
These adults are training children the dark arts of political tactics.
These, like, escalations, these actions can be really, really dangerous for a lot of folks.
Actions like burning buildings are legitimate and powerful forms of resistance.
High-risk political actions such as targeting triggering events, escalating police response towards arrest and violence, exploiting tragedies to push a political agenda. They teach how to capitalize on mass shootings, the pandemic, or natural disasters, and how to exploit them for political purposes.
Does anybody have an idea about what a trigger event is? Coronavirus. Yes. Somebody said mass shootings. That's a really good example. Trigger events are events that are creating opportunities for, like, mass participation and polarization. There are ways to create trigger events, but there are also be times when, like, trigger events happen outside of our movement or, like, outside of our hubs, like the coronavirus. And it's, like, sort of the left's job and, like, the movement for social justice, our job to, like, connect the coronavirus to, like, other issues of, like, economic and racial justice, to bring as many people as possible into the fight.
Sunrise Movement Hub Guide to Digital Tools. These are documents that every hub is given to read and to understand, such as resistance training. Also, we have SwarmWise, the tactical manual to changing the world.
think tanks, and research institutes provide Green New Deal publications and education materials through organizations like Momentum, who provide training and logistics capabilities for many youth organizations with leftist causes. They provide manuals, coursework, and instruction, offering various levels of training and involvement. On the surface, the Sunrise Movement is a group of peaceful young activists fighting for a Green New Deal. On a deeper level, they are a gateway to radicalization, teaching young activists how to exploit tragedy, including one's own victimization, for political gain. This starts with Green Team and Red Team training.
Amelia's going to text potential Red Team. Two minors are going to get arrested. Their parents will be in D.C. Our lawyer is down to support 9 people on the Red Team. We might plug in some D.C. hub people. Let's keep teenagers on the front line. We should have a Green Team plan for people who can't get arrested. Here is the adult coordinating these kids. There's Abby from the planning, leading them on and pushing in. So here we see Green Team leaving. These are all the kids designated not to get arrested. In the back, who's remaining are kids who have been recruited to get arrested, pushing the law to the point where they're forced to be arrested, and then claim it is the government trying to silence you. And in these photographs, we see a clear distinction between Green Team and Red Team here. And we have Sunrise Movement flaunting and hugging around an arrest form. Notice to arrested persons. Everyone on the Red Team, members of the Red Team, with their arrest forms.
One group, the Green Team, is trained for peaceful protesting. The other group, the Red Team, is trained for high-risk action. They even instruct these young children to put themselves on the front line so that the media can then spin it as police attacking and arresting children.
So I wasn't sure what the expectation was, say, if there was a protest being held by the Sunrise Movement that escalated with police violence. If the expectation is to disperse and avoid any violent confrontation on our part, or if it's to stay and what happens, happens.
Yeah, I would say in instances of police violence, I guess it's like, it's sort of like a two-track thing. I know there's like, people talk about like a paradox of repression of like, if you can get like instances of like state violence or other like repression of protesters, it can like become like a major media event and get a, like win a lot of active popular support. So I think if there are people, I'm down to like go through this for the sake of like exposing the cruelty of the police to the public.
This can be used to create the appearance that the government is oppressing their movement. We even have internal communications of one of the Sunrise Movement's organizers. She wrote concerned that this is child endangerment and that too many children are willing to get arrested.
If we are going to be working with young kids again, I would like to get more training on what's legal. Rose and I kept chatting about the action and were worried about child endangerment. More people than I expected wanted to get arrested. I feel like we did prepare people for escalation.
Is that really even shocking, though, when considering the potential for things getting out of control when you're teaching children that burning down buildings is a legitimate form of protest?
Actions like burning buildings are legitimate and powerful forms of resistance.
They organized around tactics for using COVID-19 as a trigger point to escalate political dissent.
Knowing that there are trigger events, should our hub, like, maybe use this time to plan what type of action we would do if there was a trigger event?
I think, honestly, I would look at working with your hub to think of trigger events you could create in your community, especially in response to, like, coronavirus and coronavirus-adjacent things.
How we can actually take action under corona. With the Green New Deal, we know we need to have big, bold government programs come in. It's the same with this crisis. There needs to be bold government intervention. Right now, the government is not doing it. We also need to make sure that the government is seen as a solution.
This chaotic situation could be used to push more Green New Deal policies as the solution to any triggering event, getting closer to reaching a new normal, their longer-term political goal. Taking advantage of the George Floyd protests, the Sunrise Movement went forward with its pre-planned police abolition talking points.
We need to stop investing in what causes pain and punishment and start investing in what allows communities to thrive. Healthcare, education, jobs for all, affordable, clean housing, fresh air and water. And steps to getting there look like defunding the police. America's police force serves to protect a system that is fundamentally racist.
While, on the other hand, Black Lives Matter went forward with their talking points and movements that the police are the bad guys, racially targeting African Americans.
Winning justice for Black lives will be a really long fight, and it can't end when the hashtag Black Lives Matter stops trending.
Then you could see where they met right there in the middle, and offer the Green New Deal as their solution to racial issues in the United States.
We want to make sure that there's broad support for government intervention. With the Green New Deal, we know we need to have big, bold government programs come in. It's the same with this crisis. There needs to be bold government intervention.
They teach how to make content slanted in pushing their political agenda, rather than getting honest information out. This even instructs on how to hide their identity and use encryption to anonymize their content they make for social media. I mean, they're teaching these groups and these kids how to perpetuate fake news. You can't make this stuff up.
So President Trump, he's criticizing some of the networks about fake news. And here we have an organization that Millie Weaver believes, in her opinions, that's creating people that play up fake news and play up confrontations. And then there's a group in there, the red group, that is willing to be arrested and be led away by these draconian policemen, these cruel policemen. And these groups were there just to antagonize and provoke the police into arresting them. So we've got just a hell of a tumultuous rebelliousness going on in this country, and we better get a handle on it. I know the president has sent in some people into Portland recently, and we're going to cover that right at the end. But next coming up is Amazing Polly, and she's reporting on the Jeffrey Epstein saga, and also Robert Maxwell and his son Jesleen Maxwell are also featured in this. And right at the end, I'm only going to play part of it, but right at the end she brings up the information that Maxwell started a scientific journal. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about some things that I discovered of Pergamos Publishing, okay? But here we go with Amazing Polly, and she gives some amazing reports. We're going to embed this on our page, so you go to thesecrettruth.com, and you can see this whole report from Amazing Polly. So here we go with Amazing Polly.
It's all coming together. It's all coming together for me. So many strands of research that I've done over the last however many years all coalesce in this one story. The story is the arrest of Ghislaine Maxwell. You might have heard of this. Ghislaine Maxwell, pictured here, is the daughter of Robert Maxwell, but also she's accused of being the procurer of underage girls for Jeffrey Epstein in his blackmail operation. Now, there's way, way more to that story than I just said. But the thing about it is, there is a link between Robert Maxwell on the one side of Ghislaine and Jeffrey Epstein on the other side. And that link is science. The Jeffrey Epstein story is all over the news, and it is tragic. And I don't want to take anything away from the victims of the sexual exploitation that these two allegedly put these women, young women and girls, through. I don't want to take anything away from that. But the element of this that is shaping our current day predicament with the virus, with the tech takeover, with globalism. That element that is in common between Robert Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein is science and technology. The two leading men in Ghislaine Maxwell's life, both of these men significantly contributed to the technocratic world order that we live in now. Now I'm going to get to a lot of the things I'm showing you on this graphic soon, but first I want to go through some history and a reading that can kind of set the stage for you so that you have the context that I have. First, I want to read you a paragraph from a book called The Power of Systems. This book is about science and power. The idea for this volume began when I encountered a puzzling question. How is it possible that both Soviet and U.S. governmental elites embraced the same scientific methods of governance, gathered under the umbrella names of cybernetics, systems analysis, and later policy sciences, and, moreover, closely cooperated in development of these methods during the Cold War? Surely, one would think, government of communist and capitalist societies would not be amenable to the same techniques of discipline and control. But this was the case when the science of governance, cybernetics, and its sibling, the systems approach, circulated between East and West beginning in the 1950s. As is so often the case, an apparent paradox suggests a complex mechanism at work that we do not yet understand. I haven't read that book. I've just read a couple of paragraphs from it, to be honest with you. But that paragraph, those questions, have puzzled me as well. I've done a lot of research over the last 10, 15 years, and I have noticed that the themes repeat over and over. This emphasis on a scientific, technological elite. And one of the big areas that they've always been interested in, sadly, is how to control the human mind. So in this video, I want to present evidence to you that I have maybe found an answer to this question. I think that they set up the bipolar world at the end of World War II. They pit Russia against the United States. They made sure to put a dividing wall between them. They called this the Iron Curtain. I know there wasn't a real Iron Curtain, okay. But these were two separate spheres that did not know what each other's cultures were like. We were kept very separate from one another, except for the intelligence agencies, which penetrated both countries, and the science, which penetrated both countries. This was how we, the rest of the world, the citizenry, were kept in a state of bewilderment. We always felt that there was a threat from the other side. This competition that was set up by the planners at the end of World War II, or probably before, this competition justified so much evil in the name of keeping up with the technology of the enemy. My first exhibit to you that I believe shows that this is what happened comes from declassified CIA documents. This is a collection of documents called Forging an Intelligence Partnership, the CIA and the Origins of the BND, 1945 to 1949. This tells the story of something called Project Rusty, where the American military over in Germany took in more than 600 former Nazi and some Soviet spies right from the German army and German intelligence services. And they paid for them, and they housed them, and they hid them, and they used them. This operation was called Project Rusty, and the leader of it was a guy called Reinhard Gehlen. The story is incredible, and I've gone over it before, and there's probably documentaries out there. There's certainly books out there that you can read that will tell you more about it. But what this essentially did was put Germans in charge of all intelligence coming out of Russia. They were specialists in going into Soviet territory, so they told the American army, and the American army believed them. And they also were very active in Russian, Soviet-occupied Germany after the war ended. So they were all over they were the main conduit of information and intelligence about what Russia was up to after the Second World War. It's very important to remember that. And there's a really interesting document that comes from the very earliest days of adopting these spies into the American army. You see, the spies surrendered. They were taken as prisoners of war. And then they sat down with some colonels or different officers in the U.S. military, and they gave them a story. And they said that they quit the German army because they could see the future, and they knew how it was going to go. So they wanted to throw their lot in with the U.S., with the capitalist side. They didn't want to be stuck on the Soviet side. That's the story they told. In fact, here's the document laying it all out. The deliberations, decisions, and measures leading to the surrender of the organization, this is the Galen Group, to the U.S. Army. Listen to what they said. While working together, the staff members came to similar conclusions concerning the true character and real intentions of National Socialism and of Communism. Therefore, the different officers in question came to the same conclusions concerning the effect that the total defeat of Germany would have on the situation of Germany itself, of Europe, and of the world. Thus, towards the middle of 1944, General Galen, Lieutenant Colonel Baun, and Lieutenant Colonel Vessel became convinced that A, in the future, world politics would be determined exclusively by the U.S. and USSR. B, the U.S. will represent the democratic system based on the individual rights of man and will have the responsibility of protecting Western nations. The USSR will represent the principle of dictatorship, collectivism against individualism, atheism against religion, state economy against private enterprise. So you see right there, this group of defected, surrendered Nazi and German spies lay out how the world's going to go after the end of World War II. They say that's the reason they surrendered. That's not all they had to say. There's a little bit more. A shattered Germany will be between the West and the East in a state of agony. For the next decades, Germany will be in no position to become again an independent factor in European politics. In addition to that, the historical period of national states seems to be over in Europe, and it's to be replaced by a union of the European nations on an equal cultural and economic basis. This process of development, however, has not yet taken any visible form. Wow! How did these guys know that? Maybe because they were spies, so they saw the plans laid out? That can't be, because Germany hadn't planned on losing the war. So how did they know this? Who knows? But that's the sales pitch. And in case you didn't catch it, that's exactly what happened. That's the paradigm that we've been living under since the end of World War II. All right, next exhibit is to show you that right after they set up the CIA, which was the OSS, intelligence branches exploded. So spying became the occupation du jour. It was the Cold War. That's all they were going to do. They weren't going to fight with soldiers anymore. They were going to fight with information, right? And one of those very important points of information was going to be the technological race, or so they told us. And so in 1948, they set up the Office of Scientific Intelligence within the CIA to specially track scientific developments. And another thing they did, which you've probably heard of, is Operation Paperclip. Roughly 1,600 German scientists, along with their families, were brought to the United States to work on America's behalf during the Cold War. The program was run by the newly formed Joint Intelligence Objectives Agency, whose goal was to harness German intellectual resources to help develop America's arsenal of rockets, and, they never like to talk about this one, other biological and chemical weapons to ensure such coveted information did not fall into the hands of the Soviet Union. Now, this included Nazis. Apparently, Harry Truman forbade the agency from recruiting Nazis, but they didn't listen to him, and they whitewashed the backgrounds of these scientists and brought them over anyway. They did this because they said, if we don't do it, the Russians will do it. By the way, the Russians also took a whole bunch of German scientists for the same reasons as the United States did. We kind of divvied them up. The thing is, we the public are sold on the line about rockets and rocketry and the space race and nuclear weapons, and we had to stay ahead of them or they'd obliterate us. That's the line they give us most often in the public. But if you look at what they were really after, it was something else. The first director of the Office of Scientific Intelligence, Willard Mackley, traveled to Germany to set up a special program to interrogate Soviet spies. The CIA believed the Russians had developed mind control programs and wanted to know how U.S. spies would hold up against this capability if caught. He also aimed to explore the feasibility of creating a Manchurian candidate through behavior modification. Operation Bluebird was born. Bluebird later became MKUltra. It was a research activity experimenting in behavioral engineering of humans. The Nuremberg Code prohibits experimentation with humans without their consent. But they did it. They did it anyways. Why this is relevant, I think, today is because we have normalized this to such a degree that right now we are doing human experimentation in the full view of the world for these COVID vaccines. They're putting it on TV. They're saying human guinea pigs are being used. So where once we went out of our way to at least encode it into law that human experimentation is forbidden, now we celebrate it. How did we get here? The justification for taking in Nazi scientists who experimented on humans was that if we didn't do it, the other side would beat us at all these technologies, and then they would come over and conquer our lands and enslave our people and control the whole world in communism. Right? Where were we getting the idea that that was even happening? Well, from our spies, of course. And if you recall, many of the CIA's spies were German. These were the guys they put in charge of the Russian intelligence gathering. So it was a collection of 600 plus ex-German intelligence officers who were giving us the lowdown on what the Russians were doing. And they were saying crazy things like the Russians had developed mind control programs. They also were telling them that the Russians had developed remote viewing and telepathy and telekinesis and things like that. Have you seen the movie The Men Who Stare at Goats? If you haven't heard of it, it's all about this CIA experimentation with crazy things that they thought the Russians were capable of doing. And I argue it very possible that these German spies were the ones telling the United States that these were the capabilities of the Russians. So you see what I'm saying? They're playing one side off against the other.
Nothing was truer said. They are playing one side off against the other is the way that Amazing Polly ended this clip that I put up. And that's really what's going on. I want to make some comments on this Pergamos publication that Robert Maxwell headed up at one time. And she gets into that and into the clip, and I'll put it up. I'll embed. I'm going to embed her video up there also, and also Millie Weaver. We're going to embed hers too. So we'll do Millie Weaver and Amazing Polly. We'll embed both of those videos up there so you can listen to the whole thing. Getting back to Pergamos Press or Pergamos Publishing, years ago I came across something that was entitled, it was a research, Changing Images of Man. And I ran across that West Coast stuff. I think it was Stanford Research maybe. Anyway, it's from the West Coast, Joseph Campbell, Margaret Mead. These really big people, cybernetics, they were into a lot of very important things. But in there, they started talking about how to structure future generations. They ended up that we need perennial philosophy. We need to push people and to condition them into a perennial perennial philosophy stance or belief or philosophy? Well, you know, perennial philosophy, there's a book written by Aldous Huxley by that very title. And so these people have been after us for decades, if not centuries, in conditioning us and mind-washing us into a perennial philosophy type of the World Council of Churches, the National Council of Churches, the world religious idea that all religions are only based on one thing. That's really what perennial philosophy is. But what it does is it enhances the New World Order, and that's where these people are really headed in this great thing. Now, getting back to Amazing Polly, she goes on and lays out some very important points, so you need to come in to thesecrettruth.com and look at that full video, or go to her site on YouTube. Amazing Polly, need to go to that site. We'll have a click off on our site, so you just click it off and go right there. But Amazing Polly has put out some very, very, very fine videos. And that's why I put up this clip. But also Robert Barnes, American Countdown, he talks about Susan Rosenberg and her involvement with Thousand Currents now, and how that they're funding the Black Lives Matter types of movements. You got to go back. There's an umbrella organization in Chicago that the Alliance for Global Rights. You can say Global Justice out of Tucson. The Alliance for Global Justice out of Tucson is funding many of these people and many of these groups on the radical left. They came out of Nicaragua, and their focus in there was the Sandinistas and their battle for along with the Sandinistas. And then they put together this Alliance for Global Justice out of Tucson. But if you go in there and you look at their 990s and all this other stuff, you'll say that they're linked back to Tides Foundation. And the Tide Foundation was created in San Francisco by Pike and others. And then that is a nexus for many of the George Soros fundings also that are going on. And George Soros has one fund that's set up that he put in a lot of DAs, district attorneys, and state attorney generals. And we're dealing, I think they're dealing with one up there in Minnesota that received funding by one of or another of George Soros' funds. I mean, he'll use money through a lot of differently named funds, so it's hard to track some of this totally. So we get back to what's really going on in the country. What's really going on is there were groups before FDR's administration, before his death, that were trying to overthrow him. They were fascist groups out of Chicago and New York. And Smedley Butler was recruited in to become the military leader of a 500,000-man army to take over Washington, D.C. That occurred in the 30s. Smedley Butler blew the lid off of that in testimony to Congress. The leaders of this fascist group, business group, were never fully prosecuted or anything else. They're just too powerful. Well, you could say some of those elements are still behind funding these radical left groups. And why is that? Because they want to bring about world communism to the lower classes in the world to better condition and manage them and enslave them. So the people that are behind, that are involved and going forth out into the streets trying to bring about some socialistic or communist system, they're being used. You need to stop that and come back to a republic that protects individual freedoms and rights. And that's where I stand for, is I stand up for a democratic republic that protects our freedoms based on natural law and natural rights. Well, thank you for listening tonight, and God bless each and every one of you. Good night.